guilty and the ghostly. I've been so bad, I see a skin in here and voices. I can't believe it's me. The guilty and the ghostly.
I guess we kind of did have different weekends. Your son kept me up all night last night.
I was not dealing with his tomfoolery last night.
Notice how I said your son. He was being bad.
That is all you. His temper is all you.
No. Mm-mm.
Brother.
I think you just like black out whenever you get like that. You just don't remember it.
I think not.
Probably not.
We had a... I don't even know how to describe it. It's beyond huge meltdown. Because we stayed in a hotel last night for May's softball tournament. And it was just us two. And our middle and youngest. So we just got two queen beds. Plenty of room.
Yep.
Well... Sister was rage baiting Jackson.
As always.
And thought it was hilarious. Jackson did not want to share a bed with her. And so she rage baited him even more. So he was throwing a fit and he's like, I'll just sleep in the chair. No blankets, no pillow.
Mm-hmm.
Tried to get him coming to get in our bed. Nope. Wasn't having that either. So I said, I'm going to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not doing this.
And you did.
I sure did. I went to sleep.
And he continued to make so much noise, I couldn't sleep.
Oh, you poor thing.
Until about 2 o'clock. And then he finally got tired enough where he came over and laid between the two beds and the floor.
He is so hard-headed.
Oh, I know.
The most hard-headed child I've ever met in my life, other than his sister, who was rage-baiting him.
Mm-hmm.
Ridiculous.
We planned on doing this on Friday.
Yeah. I started talking. Instead of Tori falling asleep, it was Josh. Every time I looked over there, his eyes were closed. I said, are your eyes closed or are your eyes dry? Because he does wear contacts. Sometimes his eyes are just dry. He said both. I said, all right. I'm not doing this. Mm-hmm.
I was so tired.
Yeah. So... Take two. We didn't.
We are again.
Yeah, we didn't make it very far though. But I've got. So we are going to try something new. But before we do that, I just want to show off my new t-shirt, which I'll try to get a picture of it so you guys can see it a little bit better. Make sure to go find this shop on Facebook. It's Ghost Babe Afterlife on Facebook and Ghosty Baby on TikTok. Ghosty Babies, GHOSTIEBABEE. She has the cutest shirts, like throwback cartoons, cryptids, funny, very cute. She does tie-dye. She does distressed shirts. The quality's great. It's super soft. I've got another one coming, and I already have one that I'll wear later, but... Go follow her. She does some awesome stuff. So go check her out. There's some really cute ones. There's some Scooby-Doo ones I'm thinking about getting for Seth.
Yeah.
He would love them.
Oh, I bet.
So go check them out. Tell her we sent you. Tell her hi. Let's help that girl out.
Yep.
So the new thing we're trying is I think Josh is going to start opening the show with a headline or blurb from... Around the world, I guess. I don't know. I left it in his hands. I was like, this is you. This is you contributing. So
basically, you didn't really tell me that. You told me to find something crazy.
Okay, or crazy. Like I said, it's all you.
Something insane that was a headline somewhere. So
yeah.
I looked, and there's several, actually.
Because we live in a crazy world.
Oh, I know. So get this. Pro athlete arrested. Dayton Weber, a quadruple amputee professional cornhole player.
Yes.
Was arrested for murder following a shooting.
Yes. Have you seen the videos?
Yes.
That is insane. Mm-hmm. Allegedly. He hasn't been convicted. Right. Allegedly.
Well, it just says he was arrested.
Yeah. But recently I seen a video that was taken just a couple weeks before the murder where he was like allegedly snorting cocaine, shooting mm-hmm. guns, like going crazy.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, that is wild.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. Like, when I seen it on the news, I was like, wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And then I seen videos of him actually shooting a gun.
He obviously knows his guns.
Yeah. Like, I was impressed.
Yeah.
But, and then I heard this part of the news about him being arrested for that. What the hell?
Yeah. Did it say why? I haven't looked into it.
I haven't really looked that deep into it. You literally just gave me notice moments ago to look these stories up.
Well, you'll be better
prepared. Next time, I'll be better prepared. But okay. I've got a couple of them that we can just tell headlines for.
There you go.
So, in Detroit, they have robot battles.
Mm-hmm.
And they have real-life, giant, 9-foot-tall robots. Kind of like that movie that came out.
iRobot?
No. Remember the boxing robots?
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember the name of that movie. Real Steel.
That might be it.
I think that's what it was.
Yeah.
But it was Hugh Jackman and the little boy.
Mm-hmm. That was a good movie.
Oh, it was a great movie. But apparently, that's become a real thing.
It's legit.
Yeah. Which doesn't surprise me because they already have fighting robots. They're just on a different scale and a different type.
Oh, I remember us watching Robot Wars mm-hmm. all the time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it was great.
Yeah.
The carnage in there was just insane.
Yeah.
I think it was the same channel that the UFC was on. We watched that a lot.
Yeah.
Oh, and then in Europe, thieves stole 12 tons of Kit Kat bars.
It's me.
Like, what the hell are you going to do with 12 tons of Kit Kat bars?
I'd be happy. I love Kit Kat. Hang on. Let me rephrase that. I love the big Kit Kats.
Mm-hmm.
The big cats, I think, is what they're called. The Kit Kats are okay.
Yeah.
But the big cats, that's where it's at.
Yeah, you like those
the best. The chocolate to crispy ratio is much better on the big cats.
Yeah.
I love them.
Yeah.
12 tons?
12 tons. How the fuck are you going to sneak that out, first of all?
Chubby bunny.
Like... You had to steal trucks.
And what are they going to do with them?
No clue.
And where are you going to store them? Because they're chocolate. They're going to melt.
Yeah.
Where are you going to put them?
I haven't... Why are you stealing Kit Kats to begin with?
Like, could you imagine coming home and being like, Greg, why do we have a whole room full of Kit Kats?
Why are there 12 semis full of Kit Kats in our yard?
I wonder how much a Kit Kat weighs.
I have not much.
I wonder how many, you said how many, 12 tons? 12
tons. But yeah, that's just, I thought that was insane.
That is insane.
Yeah, that's crazy. 12 tons. Because a regular Kit Kat bar couldn't weigh any more than 8 ounces.
Yeah. Oh, and correction corner. So Josh made our daughter listen to our episode last week, and I said something really stupid, and I know it's not how you say it, but we get in here, I start talking, and I just lose all sense, and I said,
2 ton pounds.
I know that's not how you say it, okay? I swear I'm not an idiot. I get in here, and like, when I'm editing and I listen to it, I'm like, I'm not a stupid person. I'm not an idiot.
Well, it's because you've got so much stuff going through your mind at one time, your mouth doesn't keep up with your brain.
You're right. And because I'm trying to keep track of all the details and reading and I'm mm-hmm. trying to make sure that we're recording and the cameras right. are right and the lights are right. I'm trying to make sure you guys are interested. And so then my mind's just going 90 to nothing mm-hmm. and I say stupid shit like two ton pounds. or yeah. I was just like, did I just say that? Oh my God.
You sure did.
And I could have
heard it today.
I tried to delete it. Or actually, the first time when I edited, I didn't hear it. But then when I went back and listened to it, I heard it. And I was like, well,
there it
it's
is.
Too late now. It's We're just going to send that out to the universe.
It is what it is. I'm sure they understand nobody's perfect. But you're as close to perfection as you can be.
Oh, smooth. Okay, Casanova. Good Lord.
I do have another story that's kind of sad, though.
Oh, another headline?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, a UK wildlife park was forced to euthanize its entire wolf pack after the animals turned on each other.
I didn't agree to that.
Isn't that crazy?
I didn't agree to accept that information.
Right? I mean, they're carnivores anyway.
I wonder why they turned on each other.
They didn't have food, most likely.
Where was that?
In the UK somewhere.
Oh, that's sad.
It's very sad.
Wolves are so pretty.
Yeah, but sometimes they're devastating.
But they're gorgeous. I love watching them.
Yeah, from afar.
I'm one of those crazy white ladies. Come here, little wolfie.
You look like a friend.
Oh, that would be May. So May and I are the ones that will go pick up an animal like we don't care. May was at church Wednesday. And I'll post a picture here of our text messages. This girl, our feral, when we say we have a feral child, it's our middle one, May. And we laughed because when we were coming up with her name, we knew it had to be Gracelyn. And we both loved Gracie May. And it just, to us, sounded like country and southern. And just, we could not have picked a better name for this child because she is full country, southern, get down and dirty.
Mm-hmm.
But girly at the same time. Three possums in her lap. Three baby possums in her lap, begging to bring them home.
Yep.
And I told her no. But she also knows how I am. And she's like, she FaceTimed me. And she showed me his little ears and his little paws. And I was like, you better not bring home three. She goes, so I can bring home one? And I said, you better not bring home three. But her friend that had them, he wanted to keep them, so he kept all the
And
babies.
Thank you for that. I appreciate it.
They were so stinky. Yeah,
they were
cute.
So cute, but...
But I know, it's not feasible, but when they're looking at you with their little ears and paws, it is so cute.
But it's also a wild animal, not a domesticated one.
You can have possums as pets.
You sure can, but not in this damn house.
What if she did bring it home? We've just been hiding it. And you never knew.
Then I would have found a possum, and then it would have been a dead possum.
It already plays dead.
No, it would have been dead.
That's not nice.
Well, I would have thought it was a wild possum in my fucking house. What other choice do I have? She's always been crazy.
I know. That child. So that's our exciting, exciting life. Our feral children, sad news stories, softball, sibling rivalry. What else we got? Oh, my
Dallas
birthday?
Traffic sucks.
Oh, Dallas traffic is awful.
Yeah.
Awful. And we weren't even in Dallas, right? Forney's
no, we
like
were just
an outskirts.
Forney. Yeah, it was outside of Dallas.
So bad.
But we also tried to leave today at noon.
Yeah. On a Sunday. And my birthday was this week.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
You turned, what, 45?
Nice. Mm-hmm. No, just a young buck.
27 still?
Yeah, 27 still.
You made it 36 revolutions around the sun.
Okay. So here we are. So last week we talked about we were going to do a true crime story this week, and it was going to be one of the most infamous ones that we've done so far, most well-known, I guess I should say, that we have done so far. And we had it between two, and it was a shorter one and a longer one because of this event we're going to in a couple weeks. And I was able to pull through, It's a lot of information. I started doing it and I was like, yeah, it's definitely going to be a two-parter. And then after researching it all week, I had to say, yeah, it's definitely going to be a three-parter. There's just so much. So we are covering Ted Bundy.
Yep.
This is a big one. I'm going to just start off the top. There's a lot of trigger warnings, a lot of sexual assault, a lot of murder, obviously. So just listen carefully. I mean, I don't go into a whole lot of detail, but there is one where I don't think I'm ruining anything by saying there was one of the survivors, and she kind of later talked about what she went through. So I do kind of go into detail of what happened there. But I'll kind of give a warning before I go into that one because it's pretty gruesome. So, and you don't know much about it. You just know the general, he was a serial killer, killed women, college women.
Yeah, that's pretty much all I know.
Did you know that he kind of had a type, quote unquote?
Yeah, but I don't really remember what it was.
Okay.
I knew more about him years ago. I've probably forgotten.
Just forgot about it.
A bunch of it.
Well, on part one, we're kind of going to cover the majority of it is his life from beginning up to his first few murders. We will cover some murders this week, but a lot of it is actually his life building up to that. And I was going to say what led to it, but it's really not nothing leads you to murder except for your choice. But kind of some warning signs, red flags, and stuff like that that happened before the murders. So, with that, you ready to jump in?
Yeah, I suppose so.
Here we go. Theodore Robert Cowell was born on November 24th, 1946, in Burlington, Vermont, to an unwed mother named Eleanor Louise Cowell. Eleanor's family was deeply religious, and being unwed and pregnant was obviously considered very shameful of the time. She was considered a harlot? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, probably. There's a bunch of words like that.
We always tease our daughters when they wear short shorts. We're like, your ankles are out, you floozy. Well, abortion was illegal at the time, so her parents would send her to Elizabeth Lund's Home for Unwed Mothers in Burlington, Vermont. Do you remember these crazy names?
What do you mean?
Or were you asleep when I was telling you that?
You know, honestly, I was probably sleeping through most of what we talked about.
Well, locals would nickname it Lizzie Lund's Home for Naughty Ladies.
Yeah, I remember that one.
That's awful. That is awful.
Like, I guess back then, naughty ladies meant a little something different than it does now.
I guess. Yeah, that kind of sounds like a headline for, like, an OnlyFans now.
Yeah.
Or like a name, a yeah. username.
Yeah, or like an old school brothel.
Yeah. The home was founded in the 1890s, originally called, this one's even worse, the Home for Friendless Women. Like, that's awful.
Wow.
That's sad.
Friendless women.
Friendless women. Obviously, they had a friend because...
Yeah, they had a friend at some point.
How'd they get there?
Yeah.
Well, that's not true because there was a lot of... Okay, we'll just skip that. We'll just keep going.
We don't know why they were friendless. We'll just say that.
They were raped because it was back in the day and then abortion's illegal and you're stuck. So you might have been...
You know what? You're probably... Mostly right in a lot of cases, actually.
Yeah.
Not all.
Not all.
Not all.
Some of them just like to have a good time.
Yeah.
Good time, Sally. And sometimes unexpected things happen and you find yourself in the home for friendless women.
Yeah, the home for friendless women.
That's wild.
That's awful.
That is absolutely awful.
Could you imagine a place like that today, in today's society? It would never go over.
No. I'm glad we've moved past that.
We've moved past a lot of fucked up shit.
Yeah. When I hear some of these stories or like, she read too much, so let's throw her into the psych ward or...
Yeah.
Like,
my wife talks to me too much. Can we give her a lobotomy?
Yeah, like, that's insane.
Yeah.
I often think, like, when I do certain things, just like with my interest with true crime or the ghost, or I read some questionable books, I'd immediately be put into a psych ward. Immediately.
Yeah, there's other questionable things that would put you there. We're not going to discuss here.
Pray tell.
Oh, we can't do that here.
You're trying to keep me safe so I don't get put away?
Yeah, allegedly.
I don't know. A 48-hour stay might do me some good.
Might do us both some good.
Okay, we're moving on. Well, once Theodore was born, Eleanor listed a sailor. There were some sources that said his name was Lloyd Marshall as the father. But Lloyd Marshall would completely deny that he fathered a child with Eleanor, like said it wasn't possible, and he did not have anything to do with her or the baby. And it was never proven to be his child.
Well, yeah, they didn't have DNA back then.
No. Well, they did later. Familial DNA, which we'll talk about later.
Yeah, but did they go back and look?
No.
Okay, then why does it matter? Just messing up my whole story.
I'm going to throw a shoe at you.
Not the chancla.
The chancla is coming. Later, Eleanor would say that he wasn't the father of Ted. It was actually this Navy guy, and a lot of sources says the name was Jack Worthington. However, when this was investigated, there were no records of a Jack Worthington in the Navy at the time.
It was probably just some dude that found a... He went to the Army-Navy store and got a uniform and told her that he was in the Navy.
Used a fake name.
Gave her a fake name.
Yeah. We'll talk more about this here in just a minute. Eleanor eventually was able to return home after giving birth, but under one stipulation. Her parents basically forced her to raise Ted as her brother and them as the parents.
Mm-hmm.
And they came up with this elaborate story for all their close friends and everybody in the neighborhood that they adopted Ted, and that's how they ended up with him. And she was basically forced to go along with this, which also happened to Jack Nicholson. Mm-hmm. Which, side note, I just started reading Stephen King's The Shining this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good so far.
It's a good movie.
It's been a pretty good book. It definitely, with the book, I think it sets up a lot. Well, books always go into more detail, but it sets up a lot more in the book than what the movie does.
Well, and you got to think, the movie is has visual aids to it.
Mm-hmm.
And your book always has to have a descriptive aid. So there's always going to be more detail to a book than there will be a movie, because you're more immersed in a movie than you are, say, a book.
Well, I mean, even the backstory, though, it goes more into the backstory before they got to
And that's
to
one
the...
thing you miss in a lot of movies,
yeah.
Because let's face it, they don't have 12 hours for somebody to sit down and watch a movie.
Yeah. So it's been good.
Yeah.
Okay, let me find out where I went, because I just started talking and lost my place. Eleanor wanted to give Ted up for adoption, but her parents refused, saying this would bring shame to their family. Ted would learn this at about 14 years old by one of his cousins. This cousin would show Ted the birth certificate that was stamped with illegitimate and would go on to bully Ted about being a bastard child.
Wow, they really put that on there?
I guess so.
That's fucked up.
I guess so.
That is so bad.
That is sad. I'm glad we moved past that too.
Holy crap. How would you feel about looking at your birth certificate and seeing illegitimate? Like,
yeah. I mean, you're literally labeled the rest of your life. Yep. Literally.
From the moment you hit the ground.
You might as well just stamp it across their forehead. Which, in a lot of these stories, you feel bad for the child.
Mm-hmm.
You don't feel bad for the murderer.
Mm-hmm.
But you, a lot of these stories, you just feel bad for that child. Like, it's just awful. It's awful.
Yeah, and that happens a lot. Like, that's a lot of people's backstories are just so bad.
Heartbreaking.
That you kind of start, what's the word I'm looking for? Empathizing?
Yeah.
With them a little bit?
Empathizing, yeah.
You just kind of feel like you're, I don't know.
Yeah. Like your heart just breaks for the child.
Yeah. And it's not their fault.
No.
It's almost like they got backed into that corner and it's the only way they know how to survive.
Yeah. And then they get to that point where they start murdering and it's like, okay, well, look, this guy went through it and he didn't go off and kill all these people or do all these bad mm-hmm. things. Like, you've got to take accountability eventually, but your heart breaks for these kids.
Yeah.
It's awful.
Yeah, because at what point does treating your child like that become serial killer?
Yeah, what's that line?
What line of the abuse line does that happen? Or is that possibly part of them to begin with?
Yeah, that the whole nurture versus nature thing.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder.
And do they play hand in hand?
See, I think it's a mixture of both. I honestly do. I think it's a mixture of both. I think there's something there naturally mm-hmm. that they're born with, that something's not quite right, mm-hmm. whether it be a chemical imbalance or something's just not quite firing like it should be.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have all of these events in their lives that happen that kind of build up, and they already have, you know, they're already susceptible because of whatever's going on
mm-hmm.
that's not quite working right.
And finally they just
break. They disconnect. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they either are looking for control because they have no control, or they're looking for that thrill, or they're just looking for something. Because a lot of these people have siblings, too, that went through the same thing. He does have siblings, but they don't quite have the life that he had, which we'll talk about it in a minute. And they turned out fine. But even other serial killers, same thing. They may have grown up the same, but it also goes back to that conversation that we had with no one child has the same parents.
Yep. Yep. And I don't remember where I seen that. There was a quote that I seen that brought that to my attention.
It was on Facebook.
Was it on Facebook?
Mm-hmm.
But it was. It really made me step back and think about that. Because mm-hmm. each kid gets a different version of you.
Mm-hmm.
And it blew my mind.
Yeah. And it's very true.
Yeah.
And so it kind of makes you wonder, even with like cases like this. Yeah, even though, like I said, his is a little bit different, but even the ones that have the same upbringing, one goes on to do something horrible, the other doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Why? And is it because they have different parents at each time? Is it nurture? Is it nature? I also think it's a case-by-case basis also, too. I think it's...
Yes. Well, it has to be.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it doesn't seem like it's necessarily a nurture problem in every case. So it has to be random.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be.
Yeah.
There's no other explanation for it.
Right.
There's too much abuse in the world and too much bad shit that goes on that could push somebody over the edge. So I think it has to be something from the beginning. And eventually it just gets to a point where they can no longer control it.
Mm-hmm. Yep, they're chasing that control or high or whatever.
You know, just whatever the dopamine rush mm-hmm. or whatever it is that they're getting from it.
Yeah.
It has to be almost like a drug to them.
It is, yeah. And that's why they a lot of times escalate, because they do this one thing and that gets it to them.
Mm-hmm.
But then that just comes so normal that they've got to escalate because it's no longer fulfilling that need that they have.
Mm-hmm.
So they go on to do worse things and then worse and worse, just constantly chasing that rush.
Yep. Until they finally, because I'm sure at first they're as careful and their situational awareness is at such a heightened sense.
Yeah.
The very first few times they do that. But then they stop doing that because now it's about the thrill.
Mm-hmm.
And they get sloppy. And ultimately that's what gets them caught.
Yeah. Yeah.
which, great.
I'm glad they get caught.
But
yeah.
I wish that there was a way that we could catch them sooner than that.
Yeah.
And maybe not necessarily because they're going to hurt somebody, but maybe we could save them from
Help
themselves.
Them. And it's just kind of like that McDonald Triad thing. You know, they do see warning signs, you know, killing animals, fire, bedwetting, and that's the triad. But there's a fourth one that's not in the triad, but they're starting to notice that it has a lot to do, or a lot of these people experience is a head injury.
Mm-hmm.
That is they're starting to link that to them. So really it's four: killing animals, bedwetting.
And I could see where a head injury for sure in an abusive situation would cause someone to have problems like that, because we had a friend in the past that had a head injury and it really messed him
changed
up
him
a lot.
Completely changed him.
Yeah.
And a lot of these kids that go through this abuse, they do experience a horrible head injury. Or there's the ones where maybe they don't have the abuse at home, but there's an accident.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're like, all of a sudden he was different. He changed. So it's just, I don't know. There's just so many factors that can go into it.
Agreed.
Agreed to agree.
That was a wormhole we dove in right
Yeah,
there.
We just stepped right off on that one. Okay, back to the story. And we're just going to jump right back in.
Yep.
Very next sentence.
Sorry about that.
Very next sentence. There are rumors that were never proven that Ted's grandfather, Samuel Cowell, was actually his father.
Wow.
Yeah.
So the rumor basically is that he raped his granddaughter?
His daughter.
Daughter?
His daughter. So Ted Bundy would be his grandson's son. Because you have a dad.
Uh-huh.
You have a daughter.
Right.
He raped the daughter, who is then pregnant with his child. And she has that child.
I'm trying to wrap my mind about what the hell that would be called. Other than incest.
Yeah, it's just called incest, Josh.
I mean,
which is awful.
Yeah.
Again, and it's just, it's showing that pattern of this horrible, again, it's not proven. We're fixing to talk about it a little bit more, though. But could that, if he was, did
I mean, of
that,
course, you know, the damage that actually can cause.
And knowing that as a child, that those rumors are going around your town, that your grandfather is one you already think you're his grandfather.
Then, yeah. I'm so confused.
Do I need to draw you a picture?
So it'd be Papa Grandpa?
Yeah. Dad Grandpa.
That doesn't make sense. I like Papa Grandpa better.
Okay, whatever. What was that stupid cartoon that Seth used to watch? Ugh.
So dumb.
So stupid. But yeah. But just to... Okay, one, you're being called a bastard child and your cousin's bullying you and everybody's making fun of you because you're an illegitimate child. And then the next rumor that's going around is that your mother, who you thought was your sister, was being raped by her father and you were the product of that.
That's fucked. Like, you have to feel bad for him and his mom.
Yeah. Yeah, it's awful. We'll just continue.
That sets up a bad situation in a lot of different lights.
Yeah. And it gets awfuler-er. Awfuler-er.
We're going to check the grammar on that one.
No, that's legit. Look it up. Awfuler-er.
Okay.
So that rumor's going around, and anytime anyone would bring up Ted's paternity, Samuel would go into a violent rage and just freak out on anybody. But then that also makes me wonder, is he doing that because he is? Or that would also be that'd be awful to be accused of if that wasn't it.
Mm-hmm.
But we're fixing to go back into his history, and he's not a good guy. So it is what it is. Samuel was known to be volatile, aggressive, and abusive towards his wife and his two daughters. One account indicated that he threw his other daughter, Julia, down a flight of stairs for oversleeping. Neighbors reported that Samuel would be seen abusing pets, including kicking dogs and swinging cats around by their tails. There were also reports that Samuel would be seen talking loudly to people that were not there. So again, if history of mental illness is in the family,
mm-hmm.
it's his grandfather regardless, so it could be passed down. But then you add in the other element, if he is his father, that just makes it that much worse.
Yeah, that whole situation is just a catalyst for a huge explosion.
Yeah. Sam was also addicted to pornography. He would view it regularly, and Ted would basically have full access to it at a very young age. Like, he did not hide it, just leave it all over the house. And Ted would come, he'd find it at a very, very young age, which again will mess up a child.
Yeah, and now we live in the world where they can access it as easily as they want.
In their pocket.
Yeah.
Terrifying. Even with all of these awful traits, Ted would later, in interviews, say that he looked up to his grandfather, that he was the only, like, manly figure or man enough figure in his life, which is terrifying. But then there were also other interviews where he was like, no, he was a piece of shit. So, and you'll find that a lot in Bundy's interviews, is it's almost dependent on the day and what he wanted you to see and think about him. Like, there'd be some interviews where he'd be like, yeah, he was a piece of shit, da da da. And then there's other ones where he's like, no, he's a great man. Like, I looked up to him. He was manly. I wanted to be just like him. Even talking about his childhood, like, one day he'd be like, oh, my childhood was awful. It was awful. And then the next time he's interviewed, oh, I just went and caught bugs and played with other kids in the yard, and I got along with everybody and was super popular. And then the next one, he'd be like, I was kind of shy, quiet, awkward, and did this horrendous stuff. So it's really weird how you get, it just depends on, to me, I think it's what he wants you to see,
mm-hmm.
which you, again, see a lot with serial killers. Ted's grandmother was often the victim of Samuel and suffered from clinical depression and panic attacks. She would undergo electric shock therapy treatments to help with her mental illness. Towards the end of her life, she would suffer from agoraphobia and would rarely leave the house. So again, there's more mental illness in that family.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't know how to treat it back then. Shocker brain? It's not gonna help. Not gonna help.
No, that's the end all be all right there.
Yeah. I mean, at least it's not a lobotomy, but it's not great. It's still not great.
No.
Ted was known to be a shy, girly boy and struggled to fit in at school. Reports indicate that he showed early signs of disturbance, including a fascination with knives. One report said that Ted was 3 when he went to the kitchen, gathered all the knives, and then snuck into his aunt's bedroom where she was sleeping and laid them all around her in a circle. Just 3 years old. When she woke up and was, like, terrified, Ted just started, like, manically laughing at her and almost like he enjoyed seeing the fear coming from her at 3 years old.
What a little psycho.
Yeah. Eleanor and Ted were, I've seen some reports where they said they were sent to live with a family member. Others said that she left. Like, she picked her kid up and said, we're out. Eleanor and Ted were sent to live with one of Eleanor's uncles in Tacoma, Washington. Eleanor began going by Louise. Ted would later say that his uncle was everything that Ted wanted to be. He was educated, he had a nice car, they took family trips. But not long after, Louise would marry Johnny Bundy, a cook at a military hospital in Tacoma in 1951.
Hmm. So, going back to the knives.
Mm-hmm. What you got?
That's crazy to think about. It took me a while because I was sitting here thinking about this the whole time. What did that kid see that made him think that that was normal behavior?
Yeah.
That's not something that a normal kid does.
A normal 3-year-old just goes, yeah.
That's strange behavior.
Yeah.
And at 3, that's not something that he would just...
just do?
Well, maybe. I mean, I don't know. But I feel like there's some learned behavior there.
There has to be.
Like something that has definitely gone on to create that monster.
Yeah. I agree 100%.
That's great. I didn't know any of that.
Yep. And I didn't, which I'm sure I heard it, but just completely pushed it out. I didn't realize he wasn't born Ted Bundy and that all this happened to him.
Uh-huh.
It's wild. It's wild.
Wow.
Well, Louise would marry the cook. Did you get that? Or were you zoned out? Okay.
No. I was listening. I was just thinking also.
Well, just before Ted turned 5 years.
5 years?
5 years. He's 5 years old.
And he's now from Holland.
Yeah. It reminds me of Frozen. You see, we just say us. He would officially be adopted by Johnny Bundy and took his last name. The couple would go on to have 4 kids of their own, and Ted never really bonded with the siblings. Which, again, I can see that coming from such a rough, tumultuous home. And then your mom marries, from all accounts, a great guy. Like, he was actually a really loving dad. And they start having their own kids. Even though, from what I can read, Eleanor, Louise, she did everything she could to make up for what he went through. And almost favored may not be the right word, but like you could tell she felt guilty for what he went through. And she was very involved in the kid's life. But I can also see as a child you seeing this and saying, oh, she's starting her new life with this new guy, with these new kids. What am I?
Mm-hmm.
I'm nothing. I can see that. And again, it makes you feel bad for the child. So just a... inner thoughts, I guess. They were very involved with the kids' life. They enrolled the boys in Boy Scouts, the girls were in Brownies, and they would send these kids on like church retreats. Like they really poured all of their heart and soul into these kids. As Ted got older, he seemed to become more violent. Ted's later attorney, who wrote the book Defending the Devil, recalled that Ted would go to the store and buy mice. He would then, like, put them in a trap and almost play God with them. And he would decide which ones would live and which ones would die and would, like, torture them and basically play God with these little mice.
That's weird.
Ted was also seen hanging a cat. Okay, trigger warning again for animal abuse. I didn't say that at the beginning. Huge trigger warning for animal abuse. Ted was seen hanging a cat from a clothesline, dousing it in lighter fluid, and lighting it on fire.
Wow.
What the hell? When Ted was asked about his childhood, he would say that he spent his days fishing, catching frogs, and going on adventures with his friends. But when you ask the kids of the neighborhood, they describe a much different picture. He was too small for football. He didn't really play any sports when he was younger. He was often kind of seen as a loner, and he even had a bit of a speech impediment and was often bullied for it. He was really smart, like in his younger school years, super smart and like straight A's, great student. Still a loner, still the weirdo, still had the temper, but he was doing really well academically. It wasn't until his later school years that he kind of started going downhill academically. They would often tease him, and when he would go to shower in the locker room, away from his peers because he was bullied all the time, they would sneak in and pour freezing cold water over his head. It was known that Bundy had a temper, and he enjoyed scaring people. He would go into the woods and build tiger traps. Do you know what I'm talking about? Mm-mm. Tiger traps? Where you, like, dig a hole and put the frickin'...
Oh, like a pitfall.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
He would go to the woods and build these tiger traps. And there, one day, a little girl was walking through these woods and fell through one and sliced open her leg. So, again, even at an early age, he's seeking to cause pain and fear in others.
Mm-hmm.
Ted was often responsible for watching his younger siblings, and he really didn't, like, socialize with kids his own age at all. He would often walk the streets looking for pornography that was tossed in the trash, and then he began looking through open windows so that he could see, like, women undressing in their windows.
Wow.
And again, who's just gonna walk the block and be like, let me check this trash can for porn? What?
That's a strange thing to do.
And then start being a freaking peeping Tom? Like, I just...
Peeping Ted?
And again, it just makes you want... There were signs. There were signs.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. He was known by police after being picked up at least twice for auto theft and burglary.
Now, did they know those signs then?
Good question. I don't know. But he's freaking building a pitfall or whatever the hell you called it in the forest.
But did they know that was him at the time?
Good question. I don't know, but it's wild.
I mean, there's a lot of things that happen that there's no backstory to, I guess.
Yeah. And if you just don't know, and he's just the freaking weird kid that hangs out in the woods, you don't know what the hell he's doing, but at least he's outside.
Right.
Then you don't really...
And no, if nobody sees him dig this hole, you know, who would have thought that he would have done that?
Yeah.
I mean, it could have been just a hunter's trap.
Yeah. 8-year-old Anne Marie Burr disappeared on August 31st, 1961 from her home. Her mother, Beverly, woke up early to check on her children, and Anne was missing. Her bedroom showed no signs of struggle. It was never confirmed, and they only had circumstantial evidence that led them to believe that it was Ted. Later, before Bundy was executed, Beverly wrote a letter to Bundy asking him to confess if it was him so that she could just have some closure, because she still had no idea what happened to her child. No clue. He did not confess, but some of the things that he said points to him knowing more than he should. So they do believe it's him, just have not been able to prove it.
Mm-hmm. How sad.
Ted entered high school, and to his recollection, he was athletic and popular. But others would remember him being handsome, but very shy. Often referred to him as an introvert, he would often say that he was just a normal kid, but the others were like, no, he's not normal. Ted's stepfather, Johnny, tried to connect with Ted, but Ted would often be more withdrawn and never made an effort in the relationship with his stepdad. And Johnny just kind of, he's like, it's normal teenage angst. I'm the new guy. I'm, you know, the new dad. And he's like, it's normal to have that rift, which it is. It is. But then he's doing all this other stuff on the side that either people don't know about or they're ignoring. And it just, I just still can't wrap my head around it. Louise viewed him as a smart, smart. She just knew he was going to be successful. She knew he was going to do something with his life. And she kind of treated him like the golden boy who could do no wrong. That's often seen with a lot of these guys, too, is they have no accountability. Their mother sees them as, you can do no wrong. They're never told no. They never have to accept accountability for what they do. And it seems like that was a lot with him, too, is his mom would just, oh, it's just him being him. It's just, It's just Ted being Ted, you know. Mm-hmm. They're building tiger traps in the woods. Silly boy. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think he was ever held accountable for the stuff that he was doing. Again, I'm sure that has a lot to do with the guilt of what they went through together when he was younger. It has to. From 1965 to 1966, Ted would attend the University of Puget Sound, where his mother worked as a secretary in the communications and theater department. I double spaced after Puget. That's why I paused. I was like, wait, that's not, what?
You guys aren't going to see this, but she messed that up a couple of times.
It's the magic of editing. In 1966, Ted would then transfer to the University of Washington, where he would major in Chinese.
Interesting.
Interesting thought. He would meet his first girlfriend, Stephanie Brooks, which is a pseudonym. There are several pseudonyms in here. I will say you can find them online now, but a lot of them don't want to be associated with him.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't necessarily want their actual identity out there. So I'm using the pseudonames. Leave it at that. She had long brown hair parted down the middle, which will come up later. She came from a wealthy family, and this caused a lot of friction in their relationship. Ted believed that she was too good for him and way out of his league. After months of crushing on her, he finally decided to make his first move. The two would date for about a year, and then she would end up breaking up with Ted in 1968 after Ted decided to drop out of college. She felt like he lacked ambition and noticed that he was lying about a lot of little things, and it just like wasn't sitting right with her. And after that happened, Ted was absolutely devastated, like heartbroken, and he became very depressed. After about a year, Ted decided to go back to college to study abnormal psychology, he was particularly interested in studying the psychological variables in jury decisions. It's a mouthful.
Weird.
Very interesting. Many believe that he chose this major on purpose to better understand how to manipulate people and better understand how he could present himself in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like he's studying to be a serial killer.
Yeah, that's strange. This is methodical type shit.
Oh, yeah. And just wait. I can't remember if it's in part one or part two. He plays the long game. Like, it isn't... Ted Bundy is a petty Betty, let me tell you. He is a petty Betty.
Hmm.
And he doesn't mind wasting 5 years of someone's life just to get back at them.
Damn.
It's crazy. This did seem to be a turning point for Ted, though, because he was doing really well academically and even socially at this time. In October of 1969, he would begin dating a woman by the name of Elizabeth, which again is another pseudonym.
Mm-hmm.
She was a single mom of a 2-year-old daughter. She had left her husband, who was a convicted felon, and was trying to get like a fresh start for her and her daughter. Elizabeth, Liz, would later describe the relationship being like full of chemistry when they first met. Like, she said she was drawn to him and just instantly like fell in love and could see a future with him. Like, he charmed the pants off this girl, and she's like, this is it. This is my man. That's my man. Tori's not here, so nobody got that.
Yeah, I guess not.
Tori, I need you. But she said that like she was just instantly drawn to him, and a lot of people say that like when you first meet him, he was a very charming guy, and you know, everybody's like, oh, Ted Bundy's so hot. He's really not that much of a looker. I mean, he wasn't horrendous by any means. He needed to pluck his eyebrow, but
mm-hmm.
He wasn't horrendous. But I think it was that personality, that charm that he had, that did it for people,
mm-hmm.
which is makes me feel gross. Liz, Ted, and her daughter, they'd spend weekends together, and Ted would even stay over and get up on Saturday mornings to watch cartoons with Liz's daughter so that Liz could sleep in at first. They would go on weekend outings. He was like an avid skier. Like, he really enjoyed skiing. Ted would also start working at the University Crisis Clinic on late Tuesday nights, where he would make $2 an hour.
Wow.
$2 an hour. I should have looked.
Big baller right there.
Yeah, I should have looked what that would be now, but I forgot.
Probably minimum wage.
Probably. Well, Ted, where he was staying in a house with an elderly couple, so I guess he needed a new place to stay, and he just went door to door knocking, saying, hey, do you have a room for rent? And he came to the Rogers family, and Mr. Rogers was really sick and physically could not keep up with the house anymore, so he told Mrs. Rogers, like, I'll help you with the yard work. I'll help you work on the house if I can just stay in the room and rent it. And
you know what? Now that you mention it, I don't remember there being a Mrs. Rogers. What did he do with her?
Okay. I can't. Where's the chunk law? I'm throwing it right now.
I watched that show religiously as a kid.
I watched it, but I don't think I watched it religiously.
I watched it all the time.
Yeah.
But it was a little kid when I came out, when it came out.
It was a little kid when you came out?
But I was a little kid when it came out.
Okay. Well, Mrs. Rogers was like, she instantly, again, just instantly felt drawn to him. And he would end up renting a room with them. And later they would say that, like, they loved him. He was a great tenant. Like, he paid his bills, he helped around the house, he did everything he could to help them. They said there was one night where he came home super drunk, but he didn't do anything. He was just kind of loud when he came in, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And it we'll talk about, well, let me cover this part and then we'll talk about it in a minute.
We've had a few roommates like that.
They're I've had one roommate that we enjoyed having.
No, I meant that we're loud.
Oh, I gotcha. And that roommate knows who they are.
Yeah.
The others got to go.
Yeah.
Done.
Nah, most of them were all right. They just, it was their time. It was their time to spread their wings.
You make it sound like they were moved on to the.
Well, maybe they did. I haven't heard from a few of them in a while.
You never know. Well, while working at the Crisis Center, Ted would befriend Ann Rule, who was later the writer of The Stranger Beside Me, which is a huge true crime book. And I think she's the one that wrote the book about the Golden State Killer that I have. It's been several years since I've read it. It was a really good book. But she's like a huge, or she was, rest in peace, a huge true crime writer. And she became really good work friends with him and regular friends, but they met through this crisis center. And Anne would later say that Ted was very good at his job and saved many lives while he worked there. So they would call this crisis line because they're feeling suicidal, and he would talk them off the edge and keep them on. You had to keep them on the line long enough so that they could trace the call to get emergency services there. And she said he was great at it. But again, it goes to that charming
mm-hmm.
personality, and it's just weird.
Well, in that case, it goes back to control for him.
Yeah.
Because he can control, if he can control the person on the other end of the phone, he gets what he wants.
That's true. I didn't even think about that.
When he's in control of the knife, it's different.
Yeah.
So on the other end of the phone, he keeps them alive.
That's sick.
Very.
That is sick. In which, I can't remember if I wrote it in here, but there was even one where, like, there was this two-year-old drowning, and he jumped in the lake and saved them. There was this other lady where she was being robbed, and he, like, saved her. And I didn't even think, it's him playing God, choosing exactly who lives and who doesn't. That's
exactly what it is.
Terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
Terrifying.
So somebody like that has the situational of awareness of a predator, I guess. Because technically that's what they are.
Yeah, yeah.
They're after whatever prey, whether it be actually killing someone or just getting the clout for doing something.
Yeah.
Feeds that need inside of them, which is crazy.
That is crazy. I didn't even think about that. Yeah. That's sick. Well, Ted stayed in contact with his first girlfriend, and he would frequently write letters to Stephanie, only to get the occasional return letter, just basically saying, "It's great to hear from you. Hope you're doing good." Like, she was not showing any interest at all, but he was literally writing her a letter, like, every single day and calling her and trying to get a hold of her. Now, she would, when she was passing through, they would meet up and, like, grab dinner or whatever. And Ted would later confess to his buddy at work, Ann Rule, that he was actually still in love with Stephanie, even though he was now with Liz, and he just couldn't get over her. In 1972, Liz would get pregnant, but due to her and Ted's strained relationship, she ended up terminating the pregnancy.
Wow.
Ted would graduate from the University of Washington with a degree in psychology, and he was also working on the Crime Prevention Advisory Board. During this time, he was a big part in getting a law passed that made hitchhiking in Washington legal. With his position, he had access to statistics that would show the least patrolled areas in the city.
What a sick motherfucker. This just gets deeper and deeper into some sick stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I see the pattern growing now. Like, he's building, he's taking and, like, almost like building his next level with blocks. He's putting this piece here and that piece there and that piece there just to make sure that later on down the road,
he's set up.
He's set up and ready.
He's got all the information he needs.
That is fucking wild.
Yeah. Well, in January of 1973, Ted would resign from the board after being passed over for the role of director. He then began working for Kings County Law and Justice Planning, where he would work on a case study on rape victims. During this time, he would write a pamphlet for women to help prevent being attacked and raped.
Do you have that pamphlet?
I bet we could find it online.
We should have gotten that.
I mean, I don't have it in my back pocket. It's kind of weird.
Well, I mean, because that would be interesting to put up so they could see that. That's wild. This dude is something else. I didn't know any of this stuff.
Got it. Well, that was the case file. So that's from his trial. Let me see if I can find the actual pamphlet here.
Yeah, I'm looking too.
I'll get these pictures later. I've got to.
That's fine. Keep going.
Keep going. Okay.
We'll find them. We'll get that together for y'all.
Yeah. If we find it, we'll put it on the video. So I may release the YouTube video a little bit later this week. I'm going to get the audio done tonight, and then yeah. If I can find the pamphlet and stuff, I'll add it and get YouTube released as soon as I can.
See if we can add some interesting stuff in there for y'all.
Yeah.
So this is an interesting case. Like, I hate to say that.
Yeah, it's just seeing the buildup.
Gross.
It's just, he's a, I hate to say it because I think it's what he wanted, but he was just so methodical about everything. Yeah. And yeah, a lot of serial killers are, but he took it to the next freaking level.
Yeah, this is insane. Like, this is borderline genius level.
And he was super smart. He was really freaking smart.
Wow.
He would then even enter politics.
Yeah, that tracks.
He volunteered. Yeah, especially with current news. I don't want to get into all of it. I don't really want to bring up politics, but
tracks. They're all crazy.
It tracks.
Anybody that wants to get into politics is nuts.
And with the, like I said, with everything currently going on, there's some sick individuals.
And that's across the board, though. Yeah. I mean, you can't find good people. If you throw a rock, you'd hit in 100 people, you maybe hit one good one.
Well, he volunteered for Nelson Rockefeller's presidential campaign, even acting as a delegate at the RNC, which is the Republican National Convention in Miami. He also worked in Washington GOP politics, including working for Governor Dan Evans in his reelection campaign and aiding in the state Republican Party. His job for that campaign was actually to sneak into opponents' speeches and record their speeches and try to get any information that he could. He would often wear fake mustaches and wigs, and from what I understood, he loved that job. He loved going in undercover, sneaking around, and gathering this information, and then being able to bring it back and be like, look what I got. Look what I...
I mean, I could see how that would be a cool job.
Oh, yeah, 100%. But then you take on all of his other stuff, and it's like, okay, that's freaking creepy.
Yeah, this is a little bit strange. Like, first you're a peeping Tom, now you're spying on people.
Yeah, that's a little weird, Ted Bundy.
Like, either you were born for this role, or...
And that's what's crazy, is if he would have stayed on the straight and narrow path and just did this, imagine what he could have accomplished.
Yeah, especially with the way he thought about things and thought about the long game.
Yes.
Like I've seen so far.
Imagine what he could have accomplished if he wasn't a serial killer. I thought I had a spider on me, but I think it's just...
No, it's that June bug on your
throat. Stop it. There is not.
I see it.
Reports indicate that he was seen as an up-and-coming political aide with ambitions in the Washington State Republican Party. His political work helped maintain a respectable, clean-cut image that acted as a social barrier against early police suspicions. Because, again, they're not going to think, oh, this clean-cut guy that's in politics and helping write pamphlets on how to avoid being attacked. And
you know, this story kind of makes me think about the show Dexter.
A little bit, yeah.
Because he kind of was in a position to where he could contaminate the crime scene.
Yeah, and set him up perfectly.
Never be suspected.
It's wild.
I wonder if that show was partly written off of things like this.
I don't know, but we never watched the newest season. And
I've watched some of it.
I have not seen any of it.
I've seen like 2 or 3 episodes. It was good.
We need to start that from the beginning again, because that's a good show.
Yeah. I wouldn't mind watching the old one again, because I don't
think... Well, that's what I was saying.
I don't think I've seen the first 3 seasons of the first.
Oh, I did. I watched it front to back, but just haven't seen the most recent. That's another one we could start.
I think you started it before I did, but I can't remember.
No, you started Dexter before me, and I was like, what is this?
Yeah.
And then I watched it. And that's when he worked out of town, though, so we just kind of watch it on our own.
Yeah.
Well, Ted decided to apply to the University of Utah, and he would be accepted into law school at the university. He claimed that he wanted to further his career in politics and become a lawyer. The new and improved Ted would then cross paths with Stephanie again in 1973. He would meet her family, and he showered her in love and affection. They began dating, even though he was still with Liz, who was still in Washington.
Stephanie was the girl he was still in love with, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And he's going to school in Utah, and Liz is still at home in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
So they're doing the long distance thing, and Stephanie was in Utah, so they were right there together. So he's building this life with her, meeting her family, and the women did not know of each other at all because there was no social media. I mean, so they had no clue. And Ted and Stephanie would actually start to become very serious and were even talking about getting married and settling down. Ted would propose to Stephanie, and she said yes. While he still got homegirl over in Washington.
Wow.
After she said yes, he suddenly cut her off completely. She, like, completely ghosted her. Would not return her calls, would not talk to her. And she's like, what is going on? Like, I want an answer. So she started calling and calling and calling. He wouldn't answer. He wouldn't answer. Finally, he picked up the phone one day. And she's like, I demand to know what happened. Like, we were going to get married. I said yes. And he very calmly just said, Stephanie, I have no idea what you're talking about. and hung up the phone.
What the hell?
So Ted would later say it was just to get back at her for breaking up with him in 1968.
What?
He wanted to prove that he could have married her if he wanted to. So played a 5-year game just to be petty and break it off for revenge.
Wow.
Again, it shows that controlled, calculated, manipulative, psycho.
Holy crap. Plan. This guy is crazy.
By April of 1974, Ted would drop out of college again. And young, attractive, brown-haired college women go missing. So now we're going to get into the murders.
Mm-hmm.
So this one is the one I was talking about. I'm going to tell you a little bit about that day, and then I will let you know before I start going into the nitty-gritty details. 18-year-old student Karen Sparks was asleep in her basement apartment on January 4th, 1974. She was suddenly woken up just before midnight by someone beating her viciously with a metal bar that was removed from her bed frame, and then she would be sexually assaulted with the same piece of bed frame.
Damn.
Her roommates would find her the next day beaten. And I'm going to go ahead and say now, trigger warning, because now for a little bit, it's rough. They'd find her the next day beaten and the bar shoved inside of her. Karen would survive. She spent 10 days in a coma. She suffered permanent brain damage and permanent damage to her internal organs. In 2020, Karen would break her silence of the attack for the first time. Like, in the media, I guess I should say. This is a huge trigger warning. Karen would do an interview and go on to say, "He came into my room, took a bed frame off my bed, and bashed my skull. He probably used the same bed frame and smashed it into my vagina and into my bladder. My bladder was totally split." She would go on to say that it took nearly 20 hours to be found by her roommates. In this interview, she revealed that she revealed that she had significant hearing and vision loss from the attack. At first, she didn't want to speak of her attack because in the 1970s, women were told, like, basically, this is your fault. Like, you brought this on because of the way you're dressing, because of how you acted, like, you keep this quiet, it's shameful on you. And so she's like, I just didn't talk about it because I just wanted to move on with my life, and I don't.
And not just that, but sometimes the victim just can't.
You can't go there. You can't go there. Sparks would be only one of two to survive Bundy's attacks. She was finally ready to share her story and let her voice be heard, which I am so glad that she came to that conclusion on her own.
Yeah.
It took a long time for her to get there. I hope she's healed and mentally, and I could not imagine having to live with that for so long.
No, me either. That's tragic.
Then on February 1st, 1974, so that's just, when did I say hers took place?
I've never been good with dates.
January 4th, 1974. Then on February 1st, 1974. So not quite even a month later.
Holy crap.
And that's pretty common. These next are like literally a month apart. February 1st, 1974. 21-year-old Linda Ann Healy was out at a bar with friends when she was spotted by Bundy. She was 5'7", long brown hair parted down the middle. She ended up leaving the bar early because she did the local ski reports on a radio station, and he followed her home where she lived with her four other roommates, and they were all at home at the time. So that just goes to show how brazen he is with his attacks. at about 10 p.m., Linda would go to bed. She did share a room with another roommate, but it was kind of divided by like a thin piece of wood. So, I mean, they technically had their own area, but it was literally just a thin piece of wood that separated the bedroom. Bundy would find a hidden spare key and break into her bedroom with her roommate still in the house. He would then go on to beat Linda over the head with a crowbar. He would then remove Linda's nightgown, place it on a hanger, and hang that bloody nightgown in her closet. He then redressed her in some clothes, wrapped her head in a pillowcase, wrapped her body in a sheet, and then he would remake her bed and picked her up and then carried her out of her room. Linda's roommates were woken up by her alarm the next day, which is very unusual for her because she had to be at work super early. So normally she'd get up and go before they even knew anything. That roommate went into Linda's side of the room and she noticed that her bed was made and the room looked spotless, which is kind of weird. She said Linda normally wouldn't make her bed until she got back from work, but didn't really think much of it. They were trying to figure out where she was. So they called Linda's boss asking if she showed up at work at 6:30, and she did not. After realizing that Linda's bike was still at home and that she did not show up later, they finally called the police. When they arrived, they started searching the house. They pulled Linda's blanket back and seen the blood on her bed and found the bloody soaked nightgown hanging in the closet. Roommates didn't see it. They also discovered that the clothes that Linda had been wearing the day before were missing. Later that day, the roommates received three phone calls. The caller never said anything. There was just heavy breathing.
The worst kind of calls.
Creepy. And then there was an anonymous call that would come in stating that Karen and Linda's attacks were related. I believe to the police is where it went to. They were never able to identify the caller, and Linda's body was never discovered. Only a piece of her jawbone that would later be identified through dental records.
Wow.
Which the Golden State Killer used to do that. This was the only case that I think Bundy did, if I remember right. But the Golden State Killer would do that to all of his victims and their families. After he would attack him, he would continuously call the home. But he would say, like, weird, perverted things. Sometimes he would just breathe into the phone. Like, it's just, again, I think it's that control, knowing he has that fear over them. He's just reliving it mm-hmm. again.
That's exactly what it is.
Four skulls would later be found on Taylor Mountain. So I'm going to tell you about the four skulls, but they weren't found till like much later.
Mm-hmm.
So 1 month later, on March 12th, 1974, 19-year-old Donna Gail Manson was a college student that was known to take off for a couple of days just randomly. Like, she's kind of a free spirit. Due to this, she would not be reported for 6 days that she was missing. They searched her room and found no evidence. She was in good spirits leading up to her disappearance. Her last known location was walking to a jazz concert on the Evergreen State College campus in Olympia, Washington. Remains were found in 1978 near Eatonville and included human bones and a shirt like the one Donna was last seen wearing. However, they were never able to definitively match the remains to her. The Pierce County Sheriff's Department misplaced the remains that were found in 1978, along with the associated x-rays, hindering further investigation.
That happens way too much.
Too often. Bundy would later confess to have killed her, and he would go on to say that he burnt her head in the fireplace at his girlfriend's house at the time, Liz's house.
Wow.
Diabolical.
Just throw a head in the fire.
Diabolical.
This is insane.
All while there's a kid in that house. April 17th, 1974, Susan Elaine Rancourt would be his third victim. She left a meeting for prospective dorm counselors at Central Washington State College, and that was the last time anyone seen her alive. She was studying biology as part of the pre-med program. She was a tutor in German and science classes, and she worked at a nursing home. When she did not return to her dorm, her roommate notified the campus police, and they contacted her parents and began putting out missing person flyers. 200 volunteers would assist in the search that would spread over a 62-square-mile radius. Reports started coming in that other college girls were being approached by a man in an arm cast asking for help the day that Susan went missing. And that will come again. They described him as a tall and handsome man and said that he hurt his arm while skiing. They would help him carry books to his car, but once they were there, he would ask them to get in and start it for him. Once they noticed the front passenger seat was missing, their guard would go up and they'd get the hell out of there. May 6th, 1974, just 1 month later, Roberta Kathy Parks left her dorm to meet some friends at the Memorial Union for coffee, but never showed up. She was majoring in world religions. Her skull would also be found on Taylor Mountain, 250 miles from where she went missing in Oregon.
Wow.
So he traveled with her body 250 miles.
That's insane.
The number of abductions were escalating. Police noticed a pattern of the women. They were all young, white, brown hair with it parted down the middle, just like Stephanie. They still only had a vague description of the suspect, young, handsome man who was often seen with an injury needing help. They also had a description of his car, a tannish Volkswagen Bug with the front passenger seat missing. But at the time, there was approximately 40,000 Volkswagen Beetles on the road in the area.
Oh, there was a ton of Beetles back then. Have you seen where, like, you know, people collect cars or whatever? Like, there was a guy where we grew up, or where I grew up. You kind of grew up all over the place.
Mentally and physically.
But he had a junkyard that was just plumb full of those things. And really? I guarantee you he had at least 100.
That's wild.
At least 100. And that was what he did for a living, was he would work on Volkswagen cars and sand rails that had Volkswagen motors in them.
Hmm.
And you know who that was?
Nope.
Dad.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, just a month later, June 1st, 1974, Brenda Carol Ball was last seen leaving a tavern parking lot. She was talking to a man with his arm in a sling, and she was known to be a bit of a free spirit as well. So when friends hadn't heard from her in a couple of days, they really didn't think much of it. Brenda's school was the first one to be discovered. June 11th, 1974, so not even a month, not even 2 weeks later, his next victim was Georgianne Hawkins, an 18-year-old. She was walking behind her sorority house at the University of Washington in Seattle, just 40 feet from her door. She was going home to study for a Spanish test. Bundy approached her on fake crutches, pretended to drop his books. She stopped and was trying to help him pick them up. And then he asked her if she could take the stuff back to his car. They walked to his car so that she could help him. When she opened the door, Bundy struck her over the head with a crowbar that was hidden in the wheel well. He had the passenger seat missing so that he could hide and transport his victims in the floorboard of his car. Georgianne would suddenly wake up completely confused, like not knowing what was going on or what happened, completely disoriented from being hit over the head. And she just began talking about the Spanish test that she had coming up. And not expecting her to wake up, this completely freaks Bundy out. So he pulled over. He pulled her out of the car and began beating her with the crowbar. Her body was never found, but Bundy would later confess to kidnapping and strangling Georgianne with a stocking. He kept her body for many days. He would shampoo her hair, put makeup on her face, and he also admitted to sleeping with bodies in his bed and committing necrophilia until decomposition made it impossible. And that is where we're going to stop for part one.
What the fuck, Audrey?
Yeah.
How are you going to end on that?
So even those bodies...
What the hell?
Even the bodies in the mountain, he often would return to the site where he would leave the bodies and dress them up, do their makeup. He'd take them, sleep with them.
Wow. I'm learning a lot of new stuff tonight.
Not by free will, not by choice.
These are some insane things that this guy is doing.
Yeah. Sickening. Just the, I mean, we've touched on it 100 times, but just the methodical of every step that he does and the control that he shows. But then he does things like this where he completely loses control and attacks these women. I say loses control. I don't think he's doing exactly what he wants to do. So he's not really losing control. And then
maybe gaining control was more.
Then he takes them back and sleeps with them? And spends days with them?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of people that have trophies and they do things with stuff like that. Maybe that's his thing. Because they all have weird stuff.
They all have weird things, yeah. There's always
something weird. Maybe that was just his
little... It's their way of reliving it.
I mean, so not that that's fucking good. I'm just saying.
Not that it's acceptable. But also, maybe it's his way of reliving it for a little while. Over and over and over.
And, you know, that's another thing that you see is them keeping those so they can have those mementos to relive those moments. Just like in Dexter when he keeps those little slides.
Disgusting.
It is. It's really disgusting.
Vomitous. Ugh. Like, what?
I don't know. That just... There's something that has to go on in your brain, or doesn't go on in your brain, one or the other. It just doesn't let you feel for your fellow man whatsoever.
I just... And to prey on these women, knowing that they're going to help him, knowing that, oh, I'm hurt, please, I've dropped my books, can you help me? Knowing these nice women are like, here, bud, let me help you. Sure, I'll carry it to your car and whack him over the freaking head and shove him in his little creepy beetle. I just... It's... And like you said, just him playing God.
It is.
And that was another thing that I can't remember where I heard it or seen it, but they were talking about, you know, he kept these long relationships. And I believe it was Anne Rule they were asking. They're like, how were you safe? And she said, well, one, I was older. I was older than his victims. I was not his normal victim profile. And I think he later said in a confession or something, basically, that he could not spend more than 20 minutes with a girl that he was fixing to attack. Because once that 20 minutes is up, he has an attachment to them and he could not go through with it.
Makes sense.
So he kept it to under 20 minutes, get in there, do what he needed, get out. And she's like, and that's how I'm still here, because he was very good friends with this aunt. Like they, she's the one that took him home that night, you know, that I was telling you about, where Miss Rogers was like, oh, he was drunk as hell when he came, super loud. Anne Rule was the one that brought him home. Like they were really good friends. And so he keeps those relationships, has longtime girlfriend Liz over in Washington, another girlfriend over in Utah that he played for 5 years.
But he couldn't manipulate them fully.
Yeah.
That's where the other stuff comes in. Because he can play God in those situations.
Mm-hmm.
But he can only control those situations so much.
Yeah.
So maybe that kind of drove his insanity to the next level.
Maybe.
Because he couldn't. I don't know. I'm just trying to read him.
It's a lot.
I mean, that's a lot to take in. And just to try and understand the brain of a serial killer and how it works, especially one like this.
Mm-hmm. Like I said, I hate to say it because I think that's what he wanted. He wanted to be, oh, I'm the coolest serial killer out there. But just the amount of thought and effort he put into it is just wild. It's just wild.
It's not something like you would say is respectable in another aspect. But it's on another level. Like, it's on a totally different level than just a regular, everyday murderer.
Yeah.
I mean, this is why his name is what it is.
Yeah. And we're not even halfway there.
Yeah.
Like I said, this is a three-parter because it just gets wilder and wilder.
Yeah.
So that's where we're going to end for part one. And we will begin part two next week.
Yep.
So go like, follow, subscribe, share. Our numbers have really gone up. Our TikTok, we had a, I wouldn't say viral TikTok, but a TikTok that had huge growth for the New London School explosion. So that was kind of cool.
I don't know because I don't have TikTok.
I show you though.
She does show me.
So we appreciate the support, guys. We really couldn't, it wouldn't be as fun. Just sitting here talking to each other, but it's fun that other people find it interesting and want to listen and send your suggestions. Like I said, this is the most well-known case that we've covered. And if there's other ones you want to hear, I think this is the first time we've really dove into what is going on mentally or what our
It's thought. Definitely a much deeper dive into it, and I believe that we're kind of putting our thoughts into it a little bit more than we ever have, too.
Yeah, so let us know what you think. Do you like that? Yeah. Do you want us just shut the hell up? If you do, just move on and listen to a different podcast. But if you enjoy it...
No, I think they like our platform.
Maybe.
The listeners that we have, I think, like our platform.
Yeah. So make sure you hit that little bell notification, subscribe. We'll be back next week. So till then, so tune in next week where the guilty confess.
And the ghostly never rest.
Bye, guys.
See y'all later.
Fucked it up again.
Every time. Bring shame on your whole family.